In our previous session, we learned how to compute yields. In this session, we will take a look at what is called the yield spread and what it tells us about the bond market and what it can tell us about the economy in general. We'll also learn some valuation techniques that should look very familiar. And we'll finish with some odds and ends, including some topics that are a little bit exotic and out of the reach of the casual retail investor. So let's get started on slide number 20 with yield spreads. The yield spreads are the differences in interest rates that exist among various sectors of the bond market. In general, the shorter the maturity, the lower the rate, and the longer the maturity, the higher the rate. This is very typical. Every once in a while, we'll see it gets out of whack, but for the most part, think about it. If you're going to lend your money out for a short period of time, then you have a pretty good expectation that you're going to get your money back. If you're going to lend it out for a longer period of time, there's just more time for things to mess up, of course. And then the higher the rating of the bond, the lower the interest rate, and vice versa. So just as people who have very good credit scores get lower interest rates on their credit cards and their home mortgages and their car loans, issuers of bonds who have high credit ratings get to pay lower interest rates, and issuers that have not the best ratings get to pay higher interest rates. And of course, in the pecking order, treasuries normally carry the lowest rates. Why? Because they're considered normally the most the most safest investments. And muni bonds are next, with general obligation bonds being ahead of revenue bonds. And then corporate bonds will yield the highest rates. Non-callable will be more preferable than callable, so they will often have lower rates than callable bonds. Okay? Slide number 21. This is a look at some of the yield spreads, the differences in the treasury bonds and the corporate bonds as of March 26th. And that link will take you to today's numbers. And folks, these numbers are outrageously low. By any measure, any historical standard, you have to go back to the Great Depression to see three-month treasury, well, it's not a bond, it's a bill, three-month treasury bill, paying 0.04%. And look at the 30-year. It's a little bit more than 3%. Actually, a few months ago, it was 3%, like 2.96. And the 10-year, under 2%. Just, oh, man, who is buying these things? It's certainly, if inflation runs at 2%, which it has been, and you get less than 2%, your money's actually losing money. And corporate bonds, not much better. I mean, 10-year, 2.5. For AAA, 2.89, for AA, 3, for A, 20-year, a little bit better, but ooh. So we say that the spreads are very, very tight, as we discuss on slide number 22. Often investors will speak about the bond spreads as being tight or wide. A tight spread means the interest rates among the bonds they are evaluating are very close to one another. For example, a treasury is paying 4.8 and corporate bonds paying 5.1. That's a very tight spread. You're not getting paid that much more for taking on the extra risk of the corporate bond. A wide spread means there is a big difference between bond interest rates. Say treasuries are paying 3.2% and you find a corporate bond paying 8.2%. That's a huge 5%, well, what you'll hear in the industry is they'll say, oh, that's 500 basis points. What does that mean? Well, they just break up the one point of interest, the 1% of interest, into 100 one-hundredths, 0.01. So 1% would be 100 basis points, and 5% would be 500 basis points. And that's what you're going to hear in the industry, and you'll quickly figure out what they're trying to confuse you with. For several years, bond yield spreads were very tight throughout the 2000s until the turmoil of 2008 and 2009, and then yield spreads widened to levels not seen since the Great Depression, where nobody wanted anything other than treasury bonds, and treasury bonds went to very low rates, whereas corporate bonds went sky high because people figured that all the companies are going to go bankrupt. And in the last few years, they have narrowed significantly, as we just saw in the previous slide. So now that corporate bonds, you know, A and double A, are paying not much more than your treasuries, and the treasuries aren't paying that much to begin with. Slide 23. This is a slide from the Department of Labor Statistics that shows the inflation rate and bond yields. And it turns out that they're not perfectly aligned, but pretty darn close. As the inflation rate goes up, bond holders are very worried about lending their money because as inflation goes up, the money just by itself is becoming worth less. So they're going to demand higher interest rates from their bonds. And notice that it was kind of jagged here. It followed it fairly closely throughout the 70s, and then it went very high. And notice that the inflation rate fell precipitously between 1980 to 1984. That's when, as we discussed, Paul Volcker, the Federal Reserve Bank chairman, worked his magic to break the back of inflation. Well, it wasn't magic. It was pain and suffering by raising interest rates. I think the 10-year hit, well, here it is. This is the, probably, the ten, yeah, this is the 10-year. 10-year hit 14%. The prime rate hit 20% for just a brief moment. And notice that inflation fell precipitously, but the bond yields, see, the bond investors were torching. They were gun shy. They were torched, and they took them a while to allow the interest rates on the bonds to go down and follow the inflation rate. And then in the turmoil of 2008 and 2009, the bond yields fell very quickly. But notice that for a while there, inflation was negative. That's not good. I know you love it when prices are falling, don't you? Right, of gasoline and milk. But you don't like it when your house price is falling, and you certainly don't like it when your wages are falling. And that is the economist's nightmare. That's called deflation. If you think inflation is bad, deflation can be many times worse. And so the Federal Reserve Bank and the Treasury, well, the Treasury doesn't have that much to do with it, but the Federal Reserve Bank is doing their best to stave off deflation. And I heard one person say it really well, one analyst say it. The Fed is on this slalom, toboggan ride, the luge, if you will, if you're into winter sports. And they are sliding down this mountain at breakneck speed, and on one side there's a cliff that's inflation. They don't want to fall off that cliff. And the other side is the worst cliff, deflation. They don't want to fall off of that cliff either. So they're really hanging on for dear life and hoping for the best that they make it down to the bottom without sliding off either side. Slide number 24, the yield curve. This is a graph that represents the relationship between a bond's maturity and its yield at a given point in time. And it's also used to make comparisons amongst types of bonds and the like. Normally, the yield curve is upward sloping. So what we will see when we take a look at the yield curve is we will see that the longer-term bonds have higher interest rates than shorter-term bonds and shorter-term bills and notes. That's normal. But sometimes the curve is downward sloping. It's sometimes called an inverted yield curve. And shorter-term bonds and treasury bills and corporate paper will have higher interest rates than longer-term bonds. Yeah, that's unusual, and we'll discuss it in detail in a bit. Slide number 25. Here are two examples of the yield curves. And we see that number one is the more appropriate. It's the more common way of seeing the yield curve. Shorter term, have lower interest rates, and as you go out longer and longer, the curve slopes upwardly. But the inverted curve, the downward sloping curve, number two, is more unusual. It happens, but it's more unusual, and when you think about it, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Why would that happen? Well, we'll see in a moment. So let's first now take a look at the current yield curve for treasuries. And this is a graph of what we saw a few slides back when we took a look at the yield spreads. We see that treasury bills, you know, 3 month, 6 month, they are 1 year, 1 month, I'm sorry, 1 month, 3 month, 6 month, are paying almost nothing. I mean, they're just literally paying nothing. And then even you go out to 3 years, still not paying that much. 5 year, 10 years, paying less than 2%. And then all the way out to 30 years, paying a little over 3%. But still upward sloping. We still see the bond yield curve upward sloping. And that's normal. That's what we normally would expect. And there are some theories about why that is true. Why do longer-term debt securities normally have higher interest rates than shorter-term debt securities? Well, the expectations hypothesis, this is what investors are expecting about the future of interest rates. I don't know if I like that one that much, but I certainly do like the number two. The market preference hypothesis, or sometimes called liquidity preference, investors tend to prefer the liquidity of short-term securities and therefore require a premium to invest in long-term securities. And as we said, if you're going to invest your money for a very short period of time, you have a pretty good expectation you're going to get it back. If you're going to leave it out there for a longer time, yeah, you're going to want more for that time. And that's if you've searched for mortgages, you know that a 15-year or a 20-year mortgage is going to be less interest, have a lower interest rate than a 30 or a 40-year mortgage. And the last one is the market segmentation hypothesis on slide 28. The market for debt is segmented on the basis of maturity. And there's a supply and demand component dynamic within each segment that determines the prevailing interest rate. Now, each of these theories makes some sense and each has some merit. But how do we account for the times when the yield curve is inverted? What factors could cause an inverted yield curve to occur? And what can the yield curve tell us about the future of the economy? Well, folks, slide number 29. Very interesting. Since World War II, every time the yield curve has inverted, when short-term rates were higher than longer-term rates, the economy has fallen into recession. There was only one exception, that was 1966, and the economy just barely touched 0% growth. Didn't go negative, that's what a recession is, 2 quarters, 6 months of negative growth, contraction of the economy. And this has been a very, very reliable indicator of a future recession. Currently, the yield curve is mostly upward, so that, you know, kind of shows that the bond market, at least, is not expecting a recession. But for about 2 years before the beginning of 2008, the yield curve had been inverted. Now, not by much. It wasn't inverted that much, but it was inverted. And I remember back at this time, people arguing and making their points, their cases back and forth about why the bond market was wrong or why they were right. And for 2 years, the bond market had been predicting a recession. The stock market, for the most part, didn't believe them. Stocks kept going up with the expectation of futures earnings growth. And it wasn't until the fall of 2008 that the officials charged with tracking the economy acknowledged that, yes, we were in a recession. It took over 2 years, but the bond ghouls were finally right. Now, why are they called bond ghouls? Well, it's an interesting dynamic. When the economy goes into recession, what happens? Earnings fall, and the outlook for stocks is usually not very good, so stocks do poorly. But interest rates also fall from a various set of reasons. The demand for money is less because there's less economic activity. The economy's contracting, not expanding, so there's less of a demand for money. Plus, the Federal Reserve Bank often will inject cash into the system, try to lower short-term rates, and that makes interest rates fall. And what do we know about interest rates falling? Right. If interest rates are falling, that means bond prices are rising. So they're often called bond ghouls because they're hoping for pain and suffering because that means their bonds are going to be worth more. Yeah, it's not a label that many bond investors relish brandishing, but it is true. Bonds do well normally when the economy goes into recession. Why? Because interest rates fall. I'm sure many of the bond investors would be happy for everybody to be well employed and having rising wages and the like. But hey, if you're going to be a bond investor and interest rates fall, you're a happy camper. Slide number 30. Bond pricing. Okay, now this should look familiar, folks. Mm-hmm. Bonds are normally priced according to the present value of their future cash flows. That sounds familiar. That rings a bell, does it not? Remember, from bonds, we're going to get semi-annual interest payments. We're going to get paid every 6 months. And then, at the end of the term, we're going to get our principal back. Although other factors will always need to be considered, such as the creditworthiness of the issuer. If an issuer runs into trouble, the price of their outstanding bonds will fall because investors will be afraid of default. Yeah, so that's going to affect the price. But over the long sweep of history, financial history, most bond issuers do pay their interest payments. They do pay their principal back. So we now have to keep creditworthiness in mind, but it's not the primary factor in pricing bonds. Slide number 31. What we're going to use is a model that is very familiar. The bond price is equal to the present value of the interest income that we receive every 6 months and the present value of the repayment of the principal. Do you remember in Chapter 6? I know some of you are having nightmares. remember the present value of our dividend income and then the present value of the price of the stock when we were ready to sell? It's the same idea, the very same idea. We should really use semi-annually compounding because bonds pay normally every 6 months. So we should use semi-annually. But you know what? Annual compounding is a whole lot easier to compute and will give you almost the exact same answer. So we're we mortals with our present value tables from Chapter 10 are going to use annual. With a spreadsheet, we can use semi-annually just by typing in the numbers. So what you're going to need to do is go get the present value table from Chapter 10. And it should look familiar. It should look familiar because on the left side, that table is the same table we used in Chapter 6. It's the exact same table. But now we've added on the right side another table. And let's see how we use those. Slide number 32. This is an example of a bond that I found. And the reasons I found it were to make our lives a lot easier because we're using a table that just has 4%, 5%, 6%. So I found a bond that's coupon rate is at 5.9%. It's due in 9 years, March 15th, 2022. Price to yield 4.049%. That's the yield to maturity. The current yield is 5.197%. And since 4.049 is close to 4%, let's use 4% for 9 years. So, how do we do this? Well, do you remember the discounted cash flow models? Every year, we multiply the dividend times the present value multiplier for that year. And we could do the same. We could use the table on the left, but that's a pain in the neck because, first of all, we've got 9 years we have to worry about, and we have the exact same amount every year. You see, bonds are fixed, whereas stocks, exactly. The dividend can change. The dividend can go up. That's what we like. We like when dividends go up, or the dividend could go down or be cut entirely. But no, with the bond, we know we're going to get $59.50 every year. Why? Because 5.9% of $1,000 is $59.50. So we multiply that $59.50 times the present value factor for a stream of income. That's the table on the right, the new table for Chapter 10. So you go across the 4% down 9 years, and what that present value multiplier does is says this is what you multiply that income every year if it's the same income. You know, the income doesn't change. The interest rate is fixed. So you multiply the $59.50 times 7.435, and that will give you the present value of the interest income. And so that's down here. Do that multiplication on your calculator, and you'll see that $59.50 times 7.435 is $442.38. So that income that we're getting from that bond, the $59.50 for the next 9 years, is worth to us today in present value dollars $442.38. But remember, we're also going to get the $1,000 at the end of the term of the bond, when the bond matures. And so that uses the same table we used in Chapter 6, because that's a single payment. We're only going to get $1,000 once. So $1,000, what is it worth to us today if we're going to get 4% over 9 years? Go across 4%, 9 years, and you should see 0.703. Now, we're talking about the table on the left-hand side, right? Do you understand why it's a table on the left-hand side? It's a single payment. The table on the right-hand side assumes we're getting that amount every year. We're not getting $1,000 every year. Wouldn't that be nice? No, that's not how it works. You get the $1,000 at the end of the 9 years. And so that is worth $703. The $1,000 in 9 years, assuming we're getting a 4% rate of return, will be worth to us today $703. So you add those two together, the present value of the interest income and the present value of the repayment of the principal, and you wind up with a $1,145.38. And sure enough, folks, the quoted price was $1,145. On March 26th. Now, on the website is a bond calculator spreadsheet that does all this automatically. You know, same idea as what we did in Chapter 6. We had a worksheet that did the present value calculations, the discounted cash flow calculations for our stocks. Well, now we have a one for the bonds. And you'll see that the bond calculator comes up with a smaller number for the annual payments. But once you do the semi-annual, it's almost exactly the same. And folks, this proves yet again that bonds are boring. They're fixed. And I've used this analogy in the past, and people kind of think I'm stupid, but that's okay. It reminds me of the difference between football and baseball. And what is that difference? Well, football, and most other sports, not all, is played on a field that is fixed. It's played inside a box, right? And you can't go out of bounds. Right? Whereas baseball is a diamond, and the foul lines go off into infinity, and there's really no well, I guess, you know, there is. You can't run out of the stadium, but it's up and out and just keeps going on. No, it doesn't. All right, but anyway, that's the idea. Stocks are open-ended, and for that reason, you really don't know. I mean, all the calculations we did with stocks, they were just blowing smoke left and right and hopefully putting the odds in our favor, whereas the bond calculations are almost just too easy to believe. They're just so, they're so predictable as to be almost boring. Well, of course, bonds are boring. Now, does that mean that everything's going to stay hunky-dory and things can't change with bonds? Of course not. Of course not. The one major thing that we don't know with bonds is the future direction of interest rates. But, as we've said in the past, you don't care normally. If you're buying your bonds for income, you don't care what happens to interest rates because you're going to get your interest payments and you're going to get, 99% of the time, you're going to get your repayment of the principal. Okay, so we've proven yet again that bonds are boring. And so the worksheet that you're going to do, there's two of them out there, and the assignment that you're going to do, and the problems on the exam are all going to be like this, folks. The yield calculations we did in the previous presentation, and then the pricing calculations we're doing in this presentation. I know, bonds. All right, let's continue. Slide 33, reinvestment risk. Now, this is something we need to think about. Not a whole lot that we can do about it unless we can foresee a dramatic change in interest rates, and then we can, try our best to mitigate any things that go against us and take advantage of any interest rates that go in our favor. And reinvestment risk is the uncertainty about the future value of an investor's bond investments that result from the need to reinvest bond interest payments and redemptions at yields not known in advance. Huh? What are we talking about? Well, remember, we're going to be getting our interest payments, and we're going to be getting our principal payments. What do you do with them? Well, if you're using them for income, you're living off of them. So that doesn't you don't have to worry about that. But you need to reinvest those. If you're not living off the income, if you're doing this to build your portfolio, to build your nest egg, so to speak, your investment wealth, then you have to take those interest payments and those principal repayments and reinvest them. So let's read at the bottom. Changing interest rates don't only affect the price of your bonds. They also affect your future income as you need to reinvest the interest income and bond repayments. If interest rates have fallen, oh well, your income level will fall as you reinvest that income and bond repayments, right? Because now you've got money to invest and interest rates have gone down. Hey, but your existing bonds have gone up, so you could be happy about that. And likewise, if interest rates have risen, your income level will rise. And this is why when I talk to people about bonds in general, I'm not very happy with bonds right now. I wouldn't be investing with them. I have a much bigger tolerance for risk. I lived through 2000 to 2002, lived through 2008, still have a ways to go before retirement. So, I'm staying away. I'm not that excited about them. But for people who do want that bond component, that ballast that we discussed, and are worried about current interest rates being so low, I say, look, relax. Even though I would be light on bonds at the very least, and I might, sell some of my bonds if I were a big bond investor. If you extend your time horizon, if you've got a long-term time horizon, rising interest rates are not necessarily such a bad deal. Sure, your existing bonds are going to fall in value, but all the interest payments, all the repayments of the principal are going to be reinvested at higher rates. So, there's something good that comes out of interest rates rising. As I said, I'm not a big fan of bonds, but it doesn't mean you should run for the hills, even though I think, personally, I don't think bonds are going to do anywhere near as well as stocks over the next 10 years. Come back in 10 years and see if I'm crying in my beer or happy and happy, happy. Slide number 34, duration. Duration is a measure of a bond price's sensitivity to changes in interest rates and bond yields. This captures both the price and the reinvestment risk. It is used to indicate how a bond will react in different interest rate environments. And the duration of a bond changes as it approaches its maturity date and current interest changes. And current interest rates change. Okay? So the duration is something that's changing as you get closer to the maturity. And interest rates change around the bond. In general, the longer a bond's maturity, the longer its duration, and a higher the bond's nominal rate and yield to maturity, the shorter its duration. So, you may hear serious bond investors saying, "Well, we're keeping our duration very short." Why? Because they're afraid that the interest rates are going to rise. And the shorter the duration, the less potential price volatility, and vice versa. The longer the duration, the greater the potential for price volatility. And if you believe interest rates are going to go down, sure, you'd love to have a long duration because those bonds are going to do well if interest rates fall. They're going to get hit pretty hard if interest rates rise. Now, this is where it starts to get a little silly. Duration and immunization. Yeah, this is not for you and me, folks. This is not for the vast majority of us retail investors. Investors who have a specified time horizon can use bond immunization to increase the probability of successfully achieving their desired goal. You keep the average duration of your bond investments equal to your time horizon. 5 years, 8 years, 12, 3 years, 30. You would then thus be more protected against interest rate-induced price swings. The problem with this is that it requires constant rebalancing of your bond portfolio since durations of bonds change as interest rates change and the bonds get closer to maturity. So who's going to use this? Not you and me. We're not going to use this. Who is going to, you and I, we are not going to use this. You and I would not use this. But bond mutual fund managers, pension fund managers, if you have an intermediate term bond fund, exactly, you're going to want to keep the duration of the bonds in your portfolio for the intermediate term, 3 to 5 years, and so forth and so on. And plus you have millions of dollars to invest, billions of dollars to invest. So rebalancing your portfolio is something you do all the time because bonds are maturing and you're getting interest rate payments and the like. Slide number 36. So let's end by taking a look at some bond investment strategies. There are three main strategies. Income strategy, where you purchase the bond simply for the interest income that they produce. The capital gain strategy, where you are speculating, there's that word again, that interest rates will fall. And then there's what sometimes is called the total return investment strategies, where you're purchasing the bonds for both the income plus the potential for capital gains. And which of these would be the easiest to implement? Well, certainly the income strategy. You don't care about what's going to happen to interest rates. You buy your bonds for the income. The hardest would be capital gains, because as we said, there are people who are paid tremendous sums of money to incorrectly predict where interest rates are going to go. And then total return is somewhere in between. Slide number 37. A very famous strategy is called bond laddering. And bond laddering sort of is a total return. It's a way to diversify your bonds by purchasing bonds with staggering maturities. And so some will be protected against short-term interest rates or interest rates going up, and there's also some that are going to be able to take advantage of interest rates go down because the shorter term will not be affected as much as the longer term. You purchase some bonds with short-term maturities, some bonds with intermediate-term maturities, and some bonds with long-term maturities. And who is this going to be popular with? Right, exactly. Pension funds, life insurance companies, bond mutual fund managers. They have considerable sums of money to invest, unless you're very, you know, your net worth is extremely high. Ultra high net worth, they call these people, you know, tens of millions of dollars. What are the advantages and disadvantages of these strategies? When is a good time to ladder? When is it not a good time to ladder? Well, the advantage, as we said, is we're diversified. And diversification is generally pretty good. Some of our bonds are going to mature early. They're not going to be affected by interest rate swings. And some of our bonds are going to mature much later, and they will be affected positively if interest rates go down, and negatively if interest rates go up. So when is it a good time to invest, to ladder? I think, personally, I'd always want to have this kind of portfolio if I were a bond investor, which I'm not. When is it not a good time to ladder? Well, if you believe that interest rates are going to go down, then you'd want to have everything long, right? Everything long term, because then those bonds are going to, you know, go up in value quite a bit. And if you thought that interest rates were going to go down, then you would not want to have the long term bonds. But can you guess when yeah, right. These people who are getting paid lots of money can't do it. Can you or me? I can't. You or I cannot. You or I do that. I'm not going to try. And so here we have a ladder, so to speak, of bonds. And I'll tell you, folks, this is another reason I don't like bonds. Look at those interest rates. Look how low they are. Shoot. What did we say? The long term, what did we expect from bonds over the long term? 4 to 6 to 8%. And one of them, 20-year corporate A, is paying over 4%. Everything else is below 4%. I'd much rather buy stocks that are paying 3% and growing their dividends over time. I know, it's more risky. Yeah. Okay, slide number 39. We're done! We're done with bonds. And so we're ready now to take a look at the preferred stocks and convertible securities, those hybrid securities that we made small mention of back way back in Chapter 1. And we're just going to, it's real quick, folks. It's not a big part of the investing universe. And we've essentially done all the heavy lifting for our semester. We have started by taking a look at an overview of investments, risk versus return, short-term investments, got them out of the way, took a good look at mutual funds, stocks, bonds. And after we get done these hybrid securities, which are a very small part of the investment universe, we're going to tie it all together, so to speak, in Chapter 11 with asset allocation. Okay? So that's our preview of coming attractions. Now go back over and make sure you can do the bond yield calculations and the bond pricing calculations and do those worksheets, the assignment, and bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College. See ya.